I know you're promoting two different books.
Yeah.
And I assume your personal life has been kind enough to completely go on pause while that's happening.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what happens, right? Like
no one other than your publicist needs you for anything.
Yeah, no, man. I homeschool, so this has been an adventure.
You're homeschooling the whole time you're doing this.
Yep. Yes, I am. Yep.
How old are, if you don't mind me asking, how old are your kids?
I just have one. He's 13 now. I wrote this book for him, actually, when he was 11. Yeah, so he's a fun age to homeschool because he, you know, he likes to learn stuff on his own. And basically, when I was a kid, all I wanted was to be homeschooled. And my mom was like, no, because she had three kids and she wanted us out of her hair all day, I assume. So I was like, if I ever have a kid, I'm going to homeschool him if he wants to be homeschooled, or homeschool them if they want to be homeschooled. And it turned out that he loved public school for about 5 years, and then he decided he didn't like it anymore. And so I pulled him in the middle of the school year 2 years ago, and we've been homeschooling since, which means I have had no time to write anything.
Well, you were ahead of the pandemic, though, I assume.
Yeah, yeah. I was able to make the choice to homeschool him, which was nice. And I had like these two books that were being shopped around at the time, and I was hoping that like if I got at least a good home for one of them, then my career wouldn't just completely die while I was homeschooling forever. And it turns out they both got good homes, so I was very lucky.
Well, that's fantastic. Cool. I mean, you're a full-time writer now, right? Full-time writer slash homeschool teacher slash mom slash all the 50 other hats we're all wearing. Did you have plans to continue maintaining some sort of day job, or was the plan always to go toward being an author?
I've wanted to be an author since forever. When I was a kid, I wanted to be all kinds of different things. I wanted to be a paleontologist for a long time. I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to do like all these things that kind of require a lot more like focus and dedication and decisiveness. And then I realized at one point, when I was probably about 10, that if I was an author, then I could just kind of dabble in all the things that I'm interested in and kind of live vicariously through characters. And then that's always been what's been most appealing to me, is to just be able to mess around and learn about everything and do crazy research and just have fun. And so, yeah, I've wanted to be a writer for ever, really.
What's your, you know, we should call this the start of the show, because this is already good stuff. What's your first memory of wanting to be an author?
Oh, man. I don't know. I've always loved books. Like I was my mom's firstborn kid, and I didn't really have to like share stuff with anybody, so I was reading all the time and nobody took my books from me. It was great. And so I basically learned how to read when I was 2 and just have been reading nonstop ever since. And I always, like I said, from when I was about 10, I knew I wanted to write. But then when I was about 12, my dad brought back from a used bookstore a couple of copies of the Year's Best Fantasy and Horror Anthologies by Ellen Datlow and Terry Windling, and just handed them to me without looking through them or vetting them in any way to see if they were remotely appropriate for a 12-year-old. And so I read those, and they just blew my mind. I mean, not only was there just a lot more, you know, adult content than I was used to reading, but those were what let me know what I wanted to write, that I wanted to write speculative fiction. And I just went and found all the rest of those and went through my dad's. My dad had an old, like, golden age science fiction collection, like Bester and Heinlein and all those guys, and Asimov. And I read through, like, this entire closet shelf of books, and it was just amazing. Like, when I was in fourth grade, we had to do a Prove You Read It diorama book report, and I did mine on The Stars, My Destination by Alfred Bester in Lego. And my teacher had no idea what book that was, and it was okay because I enjoyed it. So I've always been like into science fiction and fantasy. And so that was kind of a no-brainer for me that's what I wanted to write. And I started seriously trying to publish when I was like 13, 14 years old, like back in the day when you'd have to like get a self-addressed stamped envelope and send it out and get the guidelines back in the mail. And I had like my copy of Writer's Market and my stack of self-addressed stamped envelopes, and I was actually getting personalized rejections from pro markets when I was 13, and that was just beginner's luck, just absolute beginner's luck. And it's, I still don't know why that happened. It shouldn't have
Writing your
happened.
query letter, I am 13 and a
No,
dwarf.
I didn't.
You should
I did
really
not.
encourage me.
No, I didn't. I was like, and I didn't even know at the time that it was like, I was just bummed because I was getting rejections and then I kept them. And I went back and looked at them like in my early 20s. I was like, oh my God, those are personalized rejections.
Were you still getting those in your 20s? Or they got back
Sometimes, sometimes my beginner's luck had worn off by then.
Hi there, esteemed audience. My guest is Nicole Cornerstace. I'm saying that right? Author of Jillian versus Parasite Planet, which is available July in mid-July of 2021. We were discussing before. We think possibly July 20th, but it sounds like it's a little bit in flux. But check her website. It's probably available right now.
It's available for pre-order right now. That is true.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, but in terms of actual release date, it's anywhere between the 13th and the 20th, depending on who I ask.
Is that cost stress at all, or is that just par for the course?
I mean, it's par for the course, honestly. I mean, I've been so busy promoting my adult novel that just came out that I'm just like, it's this has completely snuck up on me. I was like, oh, I've got to start doing promotion for Jillian now. But I've definitely had before where, like, I had my the first book of mine that anyone's ever heard of, which is not even actually my first book, is on 2015, my YA debut, Archivist Wasp. That book was supposed to come out in May, but Amazon just kind of released it a month early for whatever reason, and I didn't know until people were like, "Hey, my copy of your book showed up," and I was like, "Oh,
Amazon
okay."
just unilaterally did that without input from your publisher,
I
or
guess I don't know. I honestly don't know what happened. That publisher hates Amazon for many excellent reasons, and so I don't imagine they were really in communication with them much at all because I think they try to like avoid Amazon as much as possible. But so that yeah, that was a surprise. So this, I mean, the fact that this is just like. Just like a week. I mean, everything's been weird. Like my book that just came out in May, Firebreak, that was supposed to have come out last year. And so I was all prepared for it to come out last year. And then they had all kinds of issues at the publisher and there was a pandemic and it got pushed back. It was actually supposed to get pushed back until sort of around next week, actually. It was supposed to come out. And then at one point, they emailed me and they're like, hey, how about May? Yeah, okay, sure, let's do it in May instead. And so I'm used to this all just being completely in flux, honestly. So a week difference does not bother me.
you just roll with the punches, and it's you're just completely used to it at this point.
I mean, I work in publishing, man. I have to.
Sounds like it. And for the record, we here at Middle Grade Ninja adore Amazon. We think they are the finest and greatest company ever. We hope they continue to list my books prominently. We think Jeff Bezos shouldn't pay taxes and use that money to go to space. Why not? you mentioned Heinlein, and I saw that some reviewers have been comparing Jillian versus Parasite Planet to Heinlein for, the really obvious reason that there's a little bit of Starship Troopers going on with it. Were you a Heinlein fan?
You know, I actually, all that old school science fiction, I read it when I was a kid and I never actually went back and reread any of it as an adult. But I'm sure that all of it just kind of has sort of taken root in my brain subconsciously, and it all kind of informs probably everything that I do. Of the books that I read at that time, like when I was like in fourth grade, when they were like way too old for me and I probably shouldn't have been reading them. The one that I remember liking the most was The Star Is My Destination by Alfred Bester. Although thinking back on some things in that book, they're like wildly problematic as like most of the books from that era probably are. They probably don't age very well. But yeah, I really should go back and read some of that stuff and just see how much of it I can trace to like, oh yeah, this was formative for me, that was formative for me, just because it I read it at such an age that it was just really that it would stick with me without me even really being aware of it, you know?
Well, that's the thing I find about having lived past a certain point, especially having been around at a time when there was no internet, there was not the same collective culture that we've come to now. We still had television shows that tried to program us, but you could go places and they were less the same. There were less, the restaurants weren't all 100% identical. Mm-hmm. The mall didn't look like the same mall you left five states ago. Where was I going with that? Well, it was a beautiful description and a lead up, but it was, I've lost it. No, I was talking about problematic literature. If you've lived long enough, anytime I talk about something I really loved when I was a kid, mm-hmm. I have to stop and go, wait a minute, I used to recommend Roald Dahl to everybody, and I know how that turned out. Yeah. Certainly Heinlein. I knew at the time I read it, like, whoa, that's not great. Mm-hmm. You should not have said that.
Yeah.
I think Asimov also.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, that was a nice conversational cul-de-sac. Let's move on. let's talk about Jillian versus the Parasite Planet and talk about your career and everything we can work in here. But esteemed audience knows I never summarize anyone else's book. Why would I make you sit through me doing that and getting it wrong? So if you would, tell the esteemed audience, what do they need to know about Jillian versus Parasite Planet to either be purchasing or pre-purchasing their copy?
Oh, wow. Well, the way I write books is I tend to kind of mash a lot of things together. And this is no exception. My agent, because she's an amazing agent, decided that the best way to summarize this book is to call it The Martian for Kids. And actually, one of the blurbers came up with that same thing, too. And I think it's a good description. So it's basically, it's a survival story. I wrote it with my son in mind. And he, at the time that I wrote this, he was 11. He was a very reluctant reader. And so I wanted to write something that he was going to find interesting to read. And he was really into survival stories, really into like outdoorsy stuff. And his favorite book at the time was Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. And yeah. And I wanted to write basically something like that, but in space. And so that's what this is. When I was pitching it, I was calling it Hatchet in Space. And then someone pointed out to me that that was wildly confusing because there's, I guess, a movie called Hatchet that's about an axe murderer. And that doesn't really go well with a kid's book. So I'm going to go with The Martian for Kids. It makes more sense and is less confusing about axe murderiness. But so Jillian is she's 11 and she has anxiety. And one thing that was really important for me to do in this book was to depict a child with anxiety the way anxiety actually looks in children. Because in media, so often the shorthand for anxiety is like, oh, they're the shy kid, like they're socially anxious. But my son has anxiety, and it actually took me a really long time to get a diagnosis for him because I didn't really know what I was looking at because I grew up with stories and in all of the media depictions that I could see in fiction, like the kid with anxiety was the shy one, was the, you know, introverted one who wasn't outgoing. And my kid is extremely outgoing, is extremely extroverted, also has severe anxiety. And so I wanted to depict that in fiction in a way that I had never actually seen it done before. But at the same time, I wanted it to be like just this big fun adventure story. And so Jillian goes to space with her parents and they have this kind of portal-based space travel. So they're ending up like on planets that are like well outside of our solar system. And their job is they're supposed to bring back resources for green tech here on Earth. And right now they're looking for this specific type of algae. And Jillian has always wanted to go to space with them, and they've always said, no, you can't, it's, you know, we can't bring you to space, you're 11, this is a bad idea. But then they surprise her on Take Your Kid to Work Day, which was my agent's idea. I said, what's the plausible reason why they would take her to space? And she goes, well, it's Take Your Kid to Work Day, and you're a good agent, and I like you. Saved me there, because I had no idea. So they take her to space, to this planet which they have been to many, many times. They know it's safe. This is like a totally low-risk environment. And, of course, things go sideways. And Jillian ends up stuck there with her parents are, out of commission, essentially. They're alive. They're just, they're not helping right now. And so she's essentially on her own, along with this kind of multi-tool space probe thing that they bring with them, which is the semi-autonomous bio-reconnoitering intelligent nanobot array, Sabrina. And so Jillian and Sabrina basically have to figure out how to stay alive on this planet, which has turned out to be extremely hostile all of a sudden, and to keep Jillian's parents alive long enough to rendezvous with the portal when it comes back in a week. And so it's a survival story in space is really the best way I can describe it. I really like the Martian for Kids comparison. It's apt. It is very science heavy. It has a parasite that I got to invent the life cycle of, which was fun.
Cross that one off the bucket list.
Absolutely. I've wanted to write something with mind control parasites for a very long time, and now I have. My dad is a molecular biologist, and he is always he was the kind of person that, like, when I was a kid, you don't want to watch science fiction movies with, because he'd sit there going, "That's not how that would work. That's not how that would work. That's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong." But he read this, and he likes the science, and he sends me reviews of my own books that he finds online, and he's like, they didn't mention how good the science is in this book. They should have mentioned how good the science is. So I'm here to tell everyone, my dad says the science is good. So I'm bad at telling synopses of my own books, as you can probably tell. It's a survival story in space with a snarky, shape-shifting nanobot array and portal-based space travel and creepy mind control parasites. And it's science fiction-y, and it's a little bit scary, and it's a little bit funny, I'm told, which is good, because I never thought that I could really write humor, but apparently I did, and that's nice. And I just had a lot of fun writing it, and I hope it's fun to read.
I won't mention the author's name because they'd be mortified if I did. But I reviewed quite a few books over the years at middlegradeninja.com, available exclusively now, esteemed audience. And I had written a very positive review of this author's book. And then her father emailed me and said, "But here are some additional positive qualities you missed." And I saved that email. It's one of my favorite things I've ever received. So kudos to that guy.
That's delightful.
I mean, maybe write the email, think about it, then don't send it next time, but still.
Yeah, the intentions are good, though. That's honestly...
You can't tell somebody when you see them just overflowing with pride for their child, but yeah.
Yeah.
Fair. So I wanted to ask a bunch of questions about the book and the science. Sure. Let's start with anxiety, because I like this description just on page 10. If I may read part of your own book to you.
Sure.
But since when did that stop her planning something out way, way, way in advance? It was how she kept her mind calm, her thoughts in order. Not only that, but it was fun. And of course, when we meet Jillian, not a spoiler, early on, yeah, she's got a very distinct plan about how many years it's going to be before she gets to space, the exact steps she has to take. So this, when I read that, I wondered, is that aspirational for you, or how is that, now I'm hearing maybe it's about your son? Does your son do this this planning out in advance to manage anxiety?
He does, and I did when I was a kid, and I still do it now. And you know, it's fascinating how different media depiction of anxiety in kids is from actual anxiety in kids, because, like, one thing that my son will do is he will ask the same questions over and over and over, and it's not that he's not listening, and some people think that he's not listening, he's not paying attention. It's not that, it's that he wants to know the exact second something changes. Like, he wants to know what's going to happen in order, and anytime there's a deviation from that, like, he wants to be apprised of it, he wants to know how to prepare for it. And, like, I'm the same way, and I think that translates really well to a survival story, or even, like, before we even get to the survival story part of this, like, how she does plan things out and how she does have this whole scheme, like, that she's trying to set in motion. And she knows, like, she's 11, but she knows that it's probably going to take her a couple of years to really, like, bring this plan to fruition, and she's totally fine with that. And that's exactly how it was as a kid, and it's how I am now. And I like being able to depict a kid like that who has that kind of long game mentality and is willing to follow through. And then, of course, when things sneak up on her in this book, she realizes, like, hey, actually, things are going way too fast. I'm not ready. This is not in keeping with my plan. And so she has a bit of a crisis there, where she's like, I don't know if I'm ready for this, because, you know, she wants to do the thing, but she wants to, you know, meet the thing on a battlefield of her own choosing, you know, on her own terms, and do it that way. And then things get sprung on her, and that kind of throws her for a loop. And that's very much my kid. And it's very much me.
Yeah. So would you, as a parent of a child with anxiety, if you had access to a space portal, say, surprise, we're going to space?
You know what? The thing is, with at least the way anxiety manifests in my son, he sometimes needs to be moved out of his comfort zone. Like, he's very much like, if he doesn't do the scary thing, he regrets not doing the scary thing. And if he does do the scary thing, he's really proud of himself afterward for having done the scary thing. But he does need a bit of a nudge. And when Jillian's parents tell her, like, hey, we're going to go to space, they give her the choice. They're like, you know, we thought this would be a fun surprise for you. We totally understand if you're freaking out right now. You don't have to go. Like, the initial plan was she was going to go and stay with her aunt. And there's like, we can call her. She could be here in 15 minutes. You do not have to come. They're not like, you know, bodily bundling her into a spaceship. They're giving her the choice. I would give my kid the choice, but I might also surprise him with it, because, like, and when they surprise her with it, like, they know she has anxiety, but also their intentions are very good. They know that she's wanted to go to space with them for years, and, you know, on face value, like, she even says to herself, like, she doesn't know why she can't, like, why her brain doesn't just let her like this. Like, why her brain gets in the way and makes her question, like, whether she should be doing this, or whether it's something she'll enjoy, or whether it's too dangerous. And that's very much my son coming through. If he gets kind of bodily nudged out of his comfort zone, he always regrets not moving outside of his comfort zone. He always is glad in hindsight when he is moved out of his comfort zone. And that's what her parents were doing there. It was with the best of intentions.
Ah, if things had gone as planned, it would have been a lovely day.
it would have. It would have had space picnics and, like, do a campfire in space with some space s'mores and do everything she wanted to do. But instead, she got to have an adventure. And, you know, it was scary, but, you know, that's what makes it an adventure, is things didn't go as planned.
We were just going to have a nice calm picnic at Jurassic Park, and, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. What could possibly go wrong, you know?
So who was the ideal reader for this story? Did you write with somebody specific in mind, or a specific type of reader that you are hoping this will find its way to?
I wrote it for really all the kids. Like, my kid is so much like me at that age. And so I really wrote it, I guess, for all the other kids who are like us, who have these big plans of adventures they want to go on, but, like, also in a way kind of timid in the actual choosing to go on the adventures. Like, when I was a kid, I had all these plans of things I wanted to do, but, like, if I'm honest with myself, I was the kid who stayed in my room all day and read books. You know, I wasn't going out and having adventures. I was reading about other people having adventures. And so And I would make plans for adventures I wanted to go on. I would have lists of the things I would bring with me. I was a weirdo, you know, and I still am, and that's okay. And I wrote it for the other weirdos, I guess, the weirdos of a younger generation who want to go off and have adventures and make lists of all the things they're going to bring with them, and, you know, maybe aren't entirely sure what they're getting into, and maybe sometimes bite off a little more than they can chew. And that's part of an adventure, too.
I have, just as we're recording this, purchased a used virtual reality for a PlayStation. So I'm like marveling at technology that came out in 2016, 2018. I'm way behind. Mm-hmm. I think that's how I'm going to adventure from now on. I did a video of swimming with great white sharks, and they swim right up to. So, oh, that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. There is no need for me to get into a cage with sharks. In the actual, nope, if somebody puts together a video of climbing Kilimanjaro, I will watch the heck out of it. I will enjoy it. I will, oh, I feel like I'm there, and I didn't get hypothermia. Fine. No frozen fingers. This is great. Mm-hmm. Which I think that's the same. One of the things that books have always provided me with is, oh, I can read about really brave people doing really brave mm-hmm. things that I would never do because it would. I can't foresee it going necessarily that well for me. I would definitely be in far more trouble than the character was in.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Maybe that's a slogan for librarians. If you're listening, you can have that. Books, mm-hmm. virtual reality of the mind. There you go.
I like it.
In the description, just a fun thing, I saw that Spaceman Spiff is mentioned. Are you a Calvin and Hobbes fan, or is that a happy coincidence?
No, it is not a happy coincidence. I am. I've read those when they were still coming out in the paper. I have all the books. I was obsessed with those, and I was, I don't know, 8-10 years old. Those were great. Again, not a conscious influence. For this, but definitely like hit me at a very formative time, and I was a very like a kid who kind of lived in my own head a lot of the time, and so I could relate to Calvin quite a bit, and you know I still can. Those were fantastic.
And then as far as the science, obviously there's. I wrote a science fiction trilogy, middle grade, and toward the end, I started to get nervous because like the technology is catching up to what mm-hmm. was speculation a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, and now I can't even write flying saucer books because they're going to disclose all the truth about UFOs and then I'm done. I'm out. Yeah. I can't lies about the aliens anymore. You're pretty far out. You've got Sabrina, which I felt like was nanobots, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yep, she's nanobots.
And you've got Sabrina, you've got portals. Do you worry about, as a science fiction writer, do you worry about the incredible, miraculous time that we're living in? That it's wonderful to live in, terrible to try to be writing speculative science fiction that's a few years out in?
Well, I mean, I'm just coming off of having... my book that just came out it takes place about the same time as Jillian, actually just several years later, I guess, in the same timeline. And it's about how, like, a lot of the reality that we're living in now, like the bad parts, like, you know, the climate change stuff and the corporate consolidation has, like, moved forward 100 years in the future to where it's literally, like, two corporations that own everything and they're all, and it's a literal civil war. And there's water rationing and electricity rationing and all kinds of fun stuff. So I think for me, it's maybe even the opposite. It's that like I can see, I guess I'm pessimistic about it, and that I see like all of the bad things that are just going to get worse, and I have a hard time like focusing on the cool stuff that might come about because just the swift collapse of everything right now that's happening. But it's really bleak. But yeah, it would be very cool if we had a portal based travel and intelligent nanobots and stuff. So I don't worry about it. I think it would be cool. And I have like kind of a weird fiction background. So if I owe the idea of Sabrina to anything, it's not even like science fiction or even reality. It's probably like Jake the dog from Adventure Time, who could like turn it to all different shapes. Like Sabrina kind of takes it a step further in that she actually can like perform different functions. But the shape shifting into anything, there's absolutely definitely some Jake the dog in Sabrina. Yeah. I don't know, I like taking influences from everywhere. And if some of these things come to pass, cool. But in the meantime, like I think there's a while before some of this reality catches up with us. And it's gonna be like my kid's gonna grow up and his generation is gonna be reading stuff that like other science fiction writers and myself have been writing now, and they'd be like, oh, this aged terribly. This stuff all, happened. This is all old school stuff now. It's like it's retro. And there's nothing I can do about that. So I just have fun with it while I can.
Fair enough. I always thought the Foundation trilogy, Asimov, I always thought that was the most optimistic science fiction writer book, this idea of a society or of a man, I believe, can predict exactly what's going to happen hundreds of years to a T. Like, oh, he wanted to be that person. And I understand. I don't think that's possible, but I like the dream of that. With the science, because you want to pass your father's smell test, you want the reviewers to say that this is solid science. How do you go about doing your research on nanobots on making a plausible portal? How plausible do you feel some of this stuff is?
Well, with the technology we have now, I mean, really, none of it's plausible. The only thing that I think really is the parasite that they encounter there. And I did a lot. I didn't really do research into portals and nanobots, like my understanding of those things. I read some stuff just in passing, but not really like as research, just as in kind of like these are cool articles that I've read over the years. And just like some like incipient technologies in those ways. Like obviously, nanobots are a ways off of Sabrina, but the parasite is very firmly based in parasites that we have here on Earth. Like there are some very, 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 very strange parasites that manipulate their host's behavior in ways that benefit the parasite to the destruction of the host. And there are so elaborate the way that evolution has designed these parasites to kind of co-evolve along with their hosts. And I read a number of books about those. I read Parasite Rex by Carl Zimmer, which that was probably the first one I read. And This Is Your Brain on Parasites by Kathleen McAuliffe. And Flight of the Living Dead, which is a fantastic, fantastic title for a book of essays about mind control parasites. That's by Matt Simon. Those were absolutely indispensable research for me with this book, because I wanted my parasite to have a viable life cycle that made sense. Like the other stuff, like the portal based space travel, is very hand wavy. It kind of has to be by definition. I didn't want to even try in a kid's book to try to give them some kind of hard science explanation for like how a portal would work or how the nanobots work. It was just part of the world that Jillian lives in, and it's explained to her in a way that she can understand, to give her kind of a working definition of how these things work. But the parasite she has to figure out for the purposes of the plot, like what it's doing and like what it might do to her and how to keep it from doing that. And so that was the part that I really extensively researched, and it was a lot of fun because it is fascinating in a very kind of squicky body horror kind of way, what parasites are doing to insects and other animals here on Earth right now. It's just fascinating.
Is there a wasp that lands in the brain? You know what? I'm gonna half remember it.
There's a the emerald jewel wasp, I think, and it like lobotomizes cockroaches, and it kind of like takes off their antennae and then drives them into a burrow and then lays eggs in it. And so the cockroach just is totally chill this entire time, doesn't try to get away, doesn't do anything, because the wasp has just very delicately lobotomized it and made it so it can't really do anything about it. And there's a fungus that preys on ants that basically like makes the ant seem entirely normal, because if the ant doesn't seem normal, the colony will be onto it and kick it out. up into the ant seems entirely normal, while this fungus is just completely invading its entire body and like enmeshing in its muscles and just literally just driving this ant around. And then when the fungus is ready to fruit, it will take the ant and tell the ant, okay, now go up this stalk of grass and go up to a very specific height at a very specific time of day, because this is the optimal place and temperature and humidity level for when the fruiting body of this mushroom comes out of the ant's head and the spores will rain down on the other ants that are marching along below. And it's just like, it's so cool.
Do you, is that a fear of yours? That there will be a parasite eventually like that for us?
No, it's like, not really. I mean, there have been a couple of books, novels recently-ish that have to do with a parasite infection that attacks humans. There was one that was called The Fireman by Joe Hill, I think. And The Girl with All the Gifts, I think, was a fungal infection, I think. That so one, it's just, yeah.
I've read that one. I've read
this, yeah, one. Yeah. So it's interesting to see that it's getting some play in fiction, because it's just like, it's low hanging fruit. It is just so much like interesting stuff there that you could work with, and there's all different things you could have a parasite do to people. It's just like, I don't know. It's really interesting, and I don't think very many people are writing about it yet, but they should be, so I can read their books because I find it fascinating.
That's the Last of Us universe, which of course is going to be a TV show, even though the game already nailed it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I still haven't played that. I've been like so lax at playing video games for the past few years. Like, I've been playing some indie games, but I haven't played anything big, even though there's all kinds of things that keep getting recommended to me over and over again. That's been recommended to me a lot. And I have not gotten around to it, but I should.
Well, I know that you've written about gaming mm-hmm. with your newest novel, and you're wearing a gaming headset as we talk. So I know you have a video game past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I've been a gamer all my life, really. Like, going way back to when I used to have to pretend to be sick so I could stay home from school, because it was the only time that I didn't have to, like, share the Super Nintendo with my brother. Because otherwise, like, our time was just, like, strictly regimented, because there was one TV and there was one console. Actually, no, rotating consoles, but one TV that we had to share. And, yeah. I like video games. I think they have a lot of merit in a lot of ways. Like, that was another thing about my son being a reluctant reader. One thing that got him, like, really improved his reading fluency is video games. And the same thing was true with my brother, as far as I can recall. Like, I remember him complaining that he couldn't read quickly. And then, like, we played a lot of JRPGs, and there'd be a lot of, like, you know, scrolling dialogue boxes. And he had to learn to read fast enough that when we would take turns playing them, and I was older than him and could read faster, so I would, like, click through the dialogue boxes faster than he could read them, so he had to get to where he would read faster, because I was, I'm not supposed to curse on this, I was being a jerk and not slowing down for him. So he had to, you know, get on the level. And it's really, a lot of parents and a lot of teachers, I think, look at video games and comics as kind of like lesser in terms of, you know, what kids could be reading or should be reading with their time. And I don't see it that way at all. I'm going on a tangent now, but I don't know. I feel strongly about this.
Tangent away.
There's so many things that kids can learn from video games, and reading is the least of them. But it's just, I think if kids are going to read and to read widely and to read well, they have to be allowed to read what interests them. And maybe that's not chapter books, and maybe it's not, you know, whatever the teacher or the state wants them to read. Maybe it's comics, or maybe it's video games, or maybe it's just, you know, texting with a friend. But it's like, it's all reading. And I don't know, I think having, like, it was very strange to me, like, because I was a voracious, compulsive reader, and I never expected that my kid would end up being a reluctant reader. And so that was kind of jarring for me for a while, because I was like, what do you mean you don't want to read for fun? Like, who doesn't want to read for fun? And so I really had to spend a lot of time trying to figure out, and a lot of trial and error. Like, we moved to a place that was within like a block of a library, so that I could just, well, first of all, get books for me, but also just be very, very experimental in like the things that I threw at him to try to figure out what he enjoyed reading, because the last thing I wanted was for reading to be a chore for him. And that was one of the reasons I pulled him out of school, is I promised him that I would homeschool him as soon as he stopped liking public school. He loved public school up until he was in fifth grade, and they started doing like middle school preparatory work, and that involved a lot of reading stuff that none of them enjoyed because it was what the state wanted them to be reading or whatever. And I had just gotten him to a place where he was starting to enjoy reading, and that just completely destroyed it for him. One of the last straws for me was that they were reading in class what was then his favorite book, Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. And rather than just reading it and enjoying it, they were kind of like reading it sentence by sentence and just vivisecting this book for like literary devices and this and that, and like taking all of the joy, just like sucking the joy out of this book. And like, it's an adventure story. It's an intense story about a kid who has to like survive on his own, and it's extremely evocative and it's very immersive, and they're like literally breaking it down sentence by sentence and like looking for like literary devices. And I was like, and it made him start to hate his favorite book, and that was just like, I was mad. And so then we spent a long time figuring out what he wanted to read, and that turned out to be, to start with, a lot of comics, a lot of video games, and now he's reading chapter books on his own by choice. But that was a huge step for him, which is, you know, a lot of why I wanted to write something that would hopefully appeal to other reluctant readers too. But it has a lot of, really all my stuff has a lot of influence from video games, comics, action movies, things like that. So, you know, hopefully they will be interesting to read. That was a long tangent.
All-time favorite video games, like obviously excluding The Last of Us, which you haven't gotten to yet.
No, I haven't gotten to it yet.
List when you get there.
Oh, my all-time favorite video games. Oh, man, I don't even know. One of my most formative video games when I was about 10 years old was Earthbound. That was a very weird game. I loved that game. That was a very, very quirky JRPG. It was the first RPG I ever played, and it just blew my mind. Like, you're playing through a story, and like you have to make decisions for the character and dialogue and everything, and I was just like, this is amazing. It's like I'm playing a book. But this was a very quirky game. Like, it was marketed with scratch and sniff materials. It had a keychain that looked like a slice of pizza, and it said Earthbound on the back, and it was a scratch and sniff slice of pizza. And there were, we used to get this, I forget what it's called, it was some video game magazine, my brother and I, and it had like this like pull-out advertisement coupon insert thing for Earthbound, and it had scratch and sniff pictures of like the different bosses you fight, and like each one of them had a smell. There was like a slime guy, and there was like a whatever. It was a very quirky game, and that was very much in the spirit of the actual game. It was weird, but I loved it. Not my favorite game, but my most formative game, certainly. Just probably because it expanded my horizons in a way. I love RPGs. RPGs are great. But lately, all I've been able to really play are indie games. And there have been a couple that have just been like really, really good. There was one that's on, I played it on Steam. I don't know where else it is. It's called The Return of the Obra Dinn. And it is this very, very indie game. And I almost couldn't play it because it almost gave me a migraine just visually. I get visual migraines. And this was the only game that I ever like played through a migraine aura to play this game, because I loved it so much. It's like It's in 1700s, I think, London. I played this a few years ago, and I'm hazy on the details, but this ship, which was presumed missing, the Oberdin, returns to port, and everybody's like, what's this ship doing here? And the ship belongs to the East India Company, and you, the character, are an insurance claims adjuster for the East India Company. And so your job is to get on the ship, try to figure out how everybody died, like who is owed money to, like what happened here. And so you get on there and you have this magic pocket watch, which it basically, if you are near a corpse, and you activate this pocket watch, it will show you like the last few seconds of this person's life. And so you get on the ship and there's literally like a corpse. And you have to go back from that and like just go deeper and deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole of like where all the other people were through time on this ship. You have the manifest, and the whole idea is you have to mat and you have a photo and a manifest, a photo of the whole crew and the passengers, and you have to write down, like match the name to the person, what they look like, and also how they died, and that's the entire game. But at the same time, it is a master class in non-linear storytelling, and it was just, I banged out that whole game in like 36 hours because I just could not stop playing it, and I like it was borderline migraine the entire time, and it was very compelling. Like I want to have my memory wiped so I can replay that game. It's just really good. It has no replay value because it's just a mystery, but oh, it was fun. I just recently played Disco Elysium, which people had been recommending to me for like a billion years, and it was again very, very good. It's like a point and click. You're going through, and you're it's not really a point and click, but it's very low key. And you're going through this town, and you're trying to solve a murder mystery. And but the way that it's done is it's just extremely, I'm gonna say quirky again. I guess I like quirky games. It's very quirky. It's basically like all of your stats, so most of your stats that you can level up are like mental attributes, and they will inform your choices. So like you are like this alcoholic cop, and you have amnesia. You have no idea. Like you woke up there, and you're like, "What am I doing here?" You're not sure if you were just like so drunk that you don't remember where you were, or what you were doing there, and you have to be told like, "Look, you're here trying to solve this crime. This is your job." But in the course of like leveling up these different attributes or internalizing these different thoughts that come to you out of nowhere, you might have yourself convinced that, you're a washed up rock star. And so then that will start informing your dialogue options and your decision making. And I don't even know like to what extent, if I went back and replayed it, I don't know how much like the choice trees actually, like the branching of the choice trees actually inform how the game ends. But there is so much cool stuff thrown in there, and it's so different, and it's so authentically itself and so different from anything else. And I think that's what I tend to appreciate most in pretty much all media is just when something is so unapologetically itself that I don't even care if it's flawed. It's ambitious and it's different. And I don't know, I have a lot of respect for that. I really enjoy that game. But I don't have a favorite, I think because I play all different kinds of games. Like I got this because I was playing, what was I playing with this lately? Or when I bought it.
This, for those listening, is the gaming headset.
Yeah, the gaming headset. I was playing like PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. It's like a battle royale game. I was playing it with a couple of people. I play a lot of just like different things. But yeah, I kind of miss it. I haven't had much time to play stuff lately. But I have eclectic taste in video games and in books and in pretty much everything, honestly, which is what makes it interesting to like just kind of draw influences from things because I just kind of cram everything into my head and see what I can make books out of.
I have you, and I'm always curious about. I talked to so many authors who you talk to one author, you talk to an author, everybody's got their own way of doing things. But I never quite understand. I don't understand teachers that don't see the value in comics or in video games. I'm 100% with you there. But I definitely don't. I've had enough authors say it to me that read, only read, never watch television, never play video games. So mm-hmm. why would you cut yourself off from such a huge part of culture?
I don't know. That I mean, obviously everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but for me, like, when I get asked about my influences as a writer, it's as many books as I've read, and I've read a lot of books, like, for a long time, but my strongest influences are visual media. It's movies, like big dumb action movies, like so many big dumb action movies.
What are your favorite comics, action movies?
My favorite big dumb action movies. Oh man. I'm a big fan of things in general that have, like, for instance, okay. So Pacific Rim is one of my favorites. And again, it's not a perfect movie. I don't care. It's fun. It is what it is. It's itself. And I really, really loved how it centered, like, a strong relationship between a male and female main character. And, like, at the very end of the movie, like, everybody's expecting them to kiss and they don't kiss. And it's great. It's so refreshing because, like, they have this very intimate relationship. They're like, they pilot a mech together. They're like, you know, mentally bonded to pilot mechs and save the world. But they very easily could have gone with the, like, okay, so they're going to kiss at the end, but they don't, because, like, being mentally bonded to pilot a mech and save the world kind of implies that you have a strong relationship without being like, okay, here's the visual shorthand of they're going to kiss. I thought that was a very refreshing. But yeah, I like Pacific Rim a lot. I like Fury Road a lot.
Another platonic relationship between them.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's my jam. I'm very much into platonic relationships in fiction. I grew up watching my dad, around the same time that he was giving me science fiction to read, he was also trying to talk my mom into letting him show me and my brother action movies that were, like, more violent than we were used to. So, like, we saw the Alien movies, we saw the Predator movies. Those were extremely formative for me.
How old are you in these?
How old was I? Sorry, when I saw those?
Uh-huh.
I was like 12-ish, 10-ish. No, probably, my brother probably was 10. I was 12, probably around there. And then, like, we got cocky. We were like, oh, we've seen all these things. We're going to go and see, you know, basically we wanted to go see a movie one time, and we're looking at the newspaper, which dates this, or it was listing the movies that were playing, and we saw that there was a movie called Event Horizon listed, and we're like, oh, that looks like it's going to be a space movie. We like space movies. And we went there, and it scared the ever-living heck out of us. we were not ready.
Technically speaking, there is some space in it.
There is some space in it, but we were like, oh, it's going to be like Aliens. It was going to be like, it was not. It was not. I don't think either of us slept for a week after watching that movie. That movie terrified us. But, yeah, I don't know. I like action movies. I like movies with, like, you know, big fight scenes and, like, cool choreography. And, you know, I don't know. I, like, fight choreography is just so much fun to watch, and I try to write action scenes in a way that reminds me of how they would be depicted in a movie. And one of the things, like, one of the nice things that people pretty consistently say about my books to me is that they love my action scenes. And if that's true, like, if people like my action scenes, I can say definitively that it's because of movies. And it's because of video games, and it's because of comics, and it's not because of books. Like, I love books, obviously, but they have not been, like, my strongest influences stylistically or thematically in pretty much anything that I've written.
Even if that were true, wouldn't your reader be thinking of action scenes from movies that they'd seen when they're your written material?
Yeah. But, like, it just comes back to that thing where some people say, like, oh, you know, books are the only fiction that's, you know, worth, I don't know, whatever, that, you know, movies and TV and video games and comics are like low art and books are high art, and that kids should only read books and they shouldn't watch movies or do, like, it's all stories. Like, why? I don't understand why you would, like, some of the coolest stories and like the most interesting and like boundary pushing stories are in movies, or they're in, you know, TV now. There's great things being done in TV now, or video games. And just to try to erase all of that from like what's valid fictional media is just a very strange mindset to me. I don't know.
It's also strange to me that if you're an author, or even just a reader, part of what you want is to have the experience of getting to intimately know another character and have experiences that you're not going to be able to have in your life. Mm-hmm. Well, yep. Good news, buddy. Put on a virtual reality helmet. Mm-hmm. And you can have an incredible version of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as authors with books available, we strongly insist that books are the strongest of all mediums. Read first, but
no, books are great. I love books.
Check out some of these games.
Yeah.
So I had a bunch of questions for you. I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about your agent, and that is Kate McKean. Mm-hmm. And is it Morhaime Literary
mm-hmm.
Agency?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you get hooked up to be represented by her?
That's actually backwards from how most people do, weirdly. Like, I had written my YA debut, Archivist Wasp, and I didn't have an agent, and I was shopping it around trying to find an agent. And it was getting rejected a lot. And it was getting rejected mostly for the same reason over and over again, which was that it has a female and male main characters, and that it basically is like an enemies to best friends situation, rather than like there's never any romantic interest. There's never any romance in that book. And I had agents telling me essentially that if I did like a revise and resubmit, adding in a romance or maybe even a love triangle, you know, they would be able to easily see their way to representing it. But as it was, they just weren't going to be able to do it because it was just, teens wouldn't find anything to relate to without a romance, which, that's when I got angry, because obviously teens will find all kinds of things to relate to without romance. I mean, even if they're not asexual or aromantic teens, they still are going to value the friendships in their lives and want to see friendships represented in fiction, I would imagine. And so
they were able to read stories in which that was valued rather than everything.
Exactly. And so I, even though I had no agent and I had no prospects for an agent, no prospects for publication, I had to stick to my guns with that. And I was like, I will make all kinds of changes to my book because, you know, obviously that's going to happen in edits and a lot of publishing is compromised, but I am not going to budge on that. That one thing, I'm not going to add romance into this book because it was a book about friendship. It was a book about strong platonic relationships, and I specifically wrote it that way because it was so hard for me growing up to find books or even movies or really anything that depicted strong platonic relationships between characters of different genders. Like, you'd find strong friendships between women, or like you can watch war movies and see like strong relationships between men, or like sports movies, but you don't typically see those outside of those genres. And if there is a relationship depicted between a male and female character, there's going to be like, it's going to turn into romance, or it's going to turn into at least sexual tension, or it's going to come up in the story, even if it doesn't need to. And so I did not budge on that. And I was prepared to like, okay, I'm going to learn how to self-publish, even though I would be terrible at it because I'm not good at marketing. And I was at a reader con one year, which is my favorite con. And I was at dinner with, who was I at dinner with? It was Ellen Kushner and Isabeau Wilse. And I had read Isabeau Wilse's books and I really liked them a lot. And I was like fangirling a little bit. And she was asking me what my book was about that I was trying, because it came up that I was trying to find an agent for this book, and I was telling her about it, and she was like, asked to read it. I was like, well, you want to read my book? Of course, please do. And so I sent it to her, and it turns out she really liked it. And she basically told Gavin Grant and Kelly Link at Small Beer Press about it. And I got an email from them saying that they would love to publish my book. And I was like, what? Because I've always loved their books. Like, they're fantastic. They put out all kinds of great stuff.
So well past and, personalized rejections at this point. They're writing you. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, that was out of the blue. And they're so on the level, Gavin and Kelly, that they told me, like, it would benefit me if I could get an agent so that I could be sure that, you know, I thought the contract was as fair to me as possible. And I was like, okay, but, you know, that didn't really work out before.
You had a bad experience with the literary agent previous?
Sorry?
I said you'd had a bad experience with a literary agent previous?
Just the rejections that I was getting before about how teens would find nothing to relate to in a book that didn't have romance, a YA book.
Already, I mean, that has to make agent shopping a little bit easier, right?
Yeah, and I hadn't actually queried Kate before, because I think she had been closed to submissions at the time. Someone had recommended her to me, but she was closed, and I didn't know at the time that you could, like, ask people, like, if you know someone who is a client of an agent, you can ask them, like, hey, can you put in a good word for me? And, like, they might look at your book, even though they say that they're closed. So I didn't know anything at the time. And so I waited for, by that time she had been, she was open to queries, and I hadn't asked her already. So I ran this by her, and we ended up thinking that we were a good match. And so, yeah, she's been my agent ever since. So
go back to one of the agents that passed with your contract and have that pretty woman moment where you go back to the board. You work on commission, right?
Yeah. No, well,
relevant middle grade reference I've made. So
yeah, I mean,
she says yes, and then at what point do you get to where you're consulting her with your story ideas? Because it sounds like she's relatively involved with Jillian, if not other books, right?
Yeah, yeah, she's very hands-on, and I that's one of the things I really love about her. Excuse me. She did, like, first pass edits on pretty much everything I've sent through her. The thing with Jillian and Take Your Kid to Work Day was the one thing that I was, like, super stumped, and I had a different thing in my query, my kind of, like, synopsis pitch for this book, and it wasn't as, like, it didn't make as much sense as just, hey, it's Take Your Kid to Work Day, they're taking their kid to work. So that was hugely helpful. But yeah, she's very hands-on, and she's amazing, and she's been great. But yeah, I kind of ran into her in a very backward sort of way, and when people ask me how did I get my agent, because I have a number of friends who are having trouble finding agents, and I'm like, I'll tell you, but it's kind of non-standard.
Yeah, that's not the kind of story that inspires hope, I would imagine.
The thing that kills me is that I understand why those agents were saying, you know, this book is unsellable because it doesn't have romance, because, like, that's what people are conditioned to expect, especially in YA. And I think it's kind of insulting to teens that, like, in middle grade, there are so many amazing friendships between kids of all genders, and there's never any talk of romance, and, like, the friendships are deep and beautiful and valid and depicted as valid. And then it's like we're telling kids that as soon as they, you know, graduate from middle grade to YA, then those friendships should be worth less to them. And that, you know, we start giving them stories about how, like, there'll be a love triangle, and the person who didn't get picked still gets to be just friends with the protagonist. And it's like, I think it's damaging, and I think it probably informs a lot of, like, bad expectations that people have for their relationships in real life, that they will go into them potentially thinking that, you know, if all goes well, maybe this won't be just a friendship. Like, friendships are devalued in media aimed at people who are older than like 10 or 12. And that continues through, you know, books aimed at adults or movies aimed at adults. Like, there's almost always going to be a romantic interest or sexual tension or whatever. And like, friendships are important too, and they should get page time, and they should get screen time. And so I don't blame the agents for saying, you know, hey, you need to write a romance into this or I can't sell it. It's just, it's industry-wide, and it's not even just, you know, the book publishing industry. It's cultural. It's just this devaluation and erasure of friendships and platonic relationships. And I wonder sometimes if friendships and platonic relationships were given more value in our fictional media, like, would that potentially make concepts like, you know, being friend-zoned less prevalent, because people wouldn't expect that, like, if a relationship is going well, then, you know, there's the friendship, which is a stepping stone to, like, a romantic relationship. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't, like, there's no reason why it should necessarily be. Like, people in real life value their friendships with people of all genders, and I don't see why that should be such a hard sell in fiction. You know?
Does seem like we would probably benefit tremendously as a society if we were to put more value into that. I mean, I know from personal experience, when I finally found my wife and said, okay, this is the person I'm going to be with forever, that made making friendships much easier from that point on, because it was always off the table. Like, mm-hmm. We don't even have to investigate that possibility. Mm-hmm. Because I'm fully committed. We can just be friends.
Mm-hmm.
And not just. How many wonderful friends do I have in my life? Right.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a real problem. And I mean, at least subconsciously, like, we culturally draw so much from stories. Just as humans, we draw so much from stories, and we use them to inform real life choices. And it's about how, like, it's just like with anything else that needs more representation. It's if we can see it depicted, then we know how to recognize it and appreciate its validity. So I write friendship books, and I will keep writing friendship books and with no romance for all ages. My YA books and my middle grade book and my adult book all are like that, because I want to do whatever I can to just add a few more books to the pile of, you know, books that do that, so that other people who are looking for that kind of relationship to be depicted in their books have another example of something that they can read, where they can see themselves reflected.
Well, you and I are in agreement. Now we just gotta get the rest of the world on board.
Yeah.
Which, thankfully, they're listening to this podcast. It's done. Problem solved. Let's see. I always want to make sure that I ask, because I ask everybody. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a flying saucer and or a ghost?
Well, I went to school in Pine Bush, New York, which is one of the UFO capitals of the world. And I never saw a UFO there. And I felt very, very disappointed and let down by that, because apart from that, that school sucked. So I wanted at least a UFO to temper my experience. And I was denied it. One time when I was a kid, I saw something that I don't really know what it was. I mean, definitionally to me, it was a UFO, because I didn't identify it, and I couldn't, and I still don't know what it was. But I didn't get a good look at it. It was at night, so it wasn't like a shape that I saw in the sky. It was more like a light that was doing a really weird thing. I was with my family, and we were watching the stars, and we were like trying to point out constellations and stuff. And then there was this light that I thought was a shooting star. We all saw it. And at first, we all thought it was a shooting star, except it was red. And it streaked up across the sky, like, you know, several inches from like what we like several inches in our view. And but it was red, which is unlike any shooting star I've ever seen. And it was huge. And we're like, wow, it's a huge shooting star. And it gets up to like, you know, a few inches up from where we saw it, and then it stops. And then it makes a 90-degree turn, and it starts going beep, 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 just like not beeping, but like blinking, going off to the right. And I'm like, I have no idea what that thing was. And we all saw it. And like I certainly don't disbelieve that UFOs would exist. Like I think it's much more likely that they exist than that they don't. And have I ever seen a ghost? I have never seen a ghost. I wrote like there are ghosts in some of my books, but they're like very non-standard ghost stories. The closest that I think that I come personally to, like, have I seen a ghost, is a secondhand kind of story. My mom, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, opened this consignment shop. And it was in this building where above it was an apartment. And there was like the people, there was like this very swift succession of people who would like rent the above apartment. And she didn't own the building. So she wasn't in contact with them at all. Like they were just dealing with her same landlord. And those like they would, weird things would happen where like my mom would be at her shop late at night, and she'd know that like the people upstairs were gone because they told her they were going to like go on vacation or whatever. And she would hear like footsteps going back and forth across like up there. And she had no idea what that was. And often like these people would come back from wherever and then they would just move out like immediately, like with like their dishes still on the table. They were just like gone. And so we always thought as kids, like, oh, it must be that it's haunted. But, you know, I have no idea. Like, maybe they just all got in trouble with them. Like, I don't know. I have no idea. Like, it was weird. It was like a movie, like, where they just, like, leave their dishes on the table and just scram, like, their clothes in the closet and just leave and just never come back out of nowhere. Like, not near when their lease was up, not near when like, their rent was due, just gone. And that coupled with the like, you know, weird footsteps and sounds up there when there was nobody supposed to be there. Like as kids, we always thought that was a ghost, but I don't remember much of that anymore. So I don't know. I'd like to see a ghost. I don't know. I think it would be interesting, but I never have. And same thing with the UFO, like that one thing, I have no idea what that thing was, the shooting star blinky blinky thing. But yeah, I'd like to. I'd like proof that there's like interesting things out there that we don't understand. I mean, obviously there's interesting things out there that we don't understand, but more is always better.
Are you hopeful with the government continuing to release documents? The CIA just dumped a bunch of their old documents. Are you hopeful that we're going to get some form of disclosure? Probably not all the answers, but something we can sink our teeth into.
I think it'd be fascinating. I would definitely be interested to know the truth. That'd be cool. Like, yeah, my brother and I have like for many, many years kind of like sent each other articles like this when they come out, and so we're both kind of waiting to see what they come up with and whether there's like any definitive answers. That would be neat.
I could use the burst of optimism because after going through the pandemic with dummies that won't wear masks to save their family, all right, I'm done watching humanity. Give me some new creatures that are smarter.
Heck yeah.
So you've got two books coming out here at the end of a pandemic. You were ahead of the pandemic because you were already homeschooling. But what does your writing life look like over the past few years, and what does it look like now? How many How much writing are you able to get done, and when do you do it?
It's bleak. It's I don't get very much done. Before the pandemic, I was getting more done, because even when I was homeschooling, like, he'd go out and do things. I had he went to a wilderness skills class because he likes the outdoor survival stuff, and he used to like go to my parents' house and everything, and so I'd have some time there. But he's old enough now that he's, you know, he works on his own projects and stuff. He doesn't really need me to hang out with him all day. And so I do get some done. It's just, I'm also kind of on call, like, all the time, because I'm kind of like the parent who's also like his buddy. And so he's constantly like talking to me and being, you know, like, hey, what you doing? Check out what I'm doing. Hey, I just built this thing and check it out. You want to try it? Sure. And so it just destroys my train of thought when I'm trying to work. But I don't hold that against him. Like, I knew what I was signing up for when I homeschooled him. So right now, just honestly, like, whatever time I can get is good, and I'm grateful for it.
Can you imagine getting to the end of your life, which is many, many, many years from now, and you're on your deathbed and you think, I wish I'd spent less time with my child and written.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, like, I can write whenever. So that can, you know, that can wait until he's older, and I'm getting bits done, but like, I'm the kind of person that if I get really into a project, I get obsessive, and then like, I get cranky if I can't work on it. And so I, like, when he's around, I actively try not to get too deep in thought on a book, because I don't want to be, like, unpleasant for him to be around. So right now I'm just kind of, like, kicking around ideas for a few things. And, you know, now that, I mean, he just got his second dose of his vaccine yesterday, so he'll hopefully be able to start going get back to my parents' house and, you know, go do various things and get some time back. But, you know, when it's safe, because that's the number one important thing.
Well, that's tremendous. Safe. Congratulations on the second shot. That should open up all kinds of opportunities.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough that he's old enough for that, because, he was very afraid to go and do that. He is very needle phobic, but he went and did it, and he was very proud of himself, and I'm proud of him too, because that was really hard for him.
Well, hopefully everyone is listening. If you haven't been vaccinated, go get vaccinated. But you've been vaccinated. You like books. You like learning. I'm not talking to folks that are hesitant. Well, my last question is always some variation of, and this has been just a delight. I always want to end while we're having fun. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate you making the time and being such a tremendous guest.
Well, but thank
my
you.
Last question is always, if you could go back toward the start of your career, middle of your career, whenever it would be useful, and give yourself some crucial advice that would have made a difference for you and might make a difference for all the writers who are watching or listening to us now, what would you go back and say?
I think the most important thing is to always have fun with it. Like, there are all kinds of steps in the writing and publishing processes that are, you know, very frustrating and very demoralizing. But like, if what you're writing isn't fun, like, you can tell when you're reading something, watching a movie or something, when you're like, you know, they had fun making this, you know? And if you write things that are fun for you to write and that only you could write them in that way, then that will shine through to the people who read it. And the fun that you had writing it will come through in the reading. And, you know, don't try to write to the market. Don't try to write to, like, what you think people are going to want to read. Like, write the story that's trying to chew its way out through the side of your head, and just see what happens.
You are in love with parasites, right? The story that chews its way out the side of your head.
It's fantastic. I am what I am.
Where can a esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media, all that good stuff?
I'm really bad at social media. I am on Twitter, and my handle there is Wirewalking. And I have a very old website, which is NicoleCornerStace.com, and you can contact me through there.
As always, esteemed audience, head to MiddleGradeNinja.com. I have prepared thousands of fantastic interviews with editors, literary agents, authors, the back catalog of the show. Everything that is good in this world is available at MiddleGradeNinja.com. While you're there, follow the link to download your free copy of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, then pay cash money for the other two books. You get the show for free. Go nuts. And as always, God willing, I'm alive. I'll see you next week. Thank you.